Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. I'm Olga Segura, along with Matt Malone, and we are talking with Mark Shriver. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. That's 1-888-322-8465. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
So one of the interesting, another one of the many interesting things I found in your book was you talk about the influence of various women in Pope Francis's life, like his grandmother Rosa and Esther, who was his boss at the chemistry lab. And for me, that was one of the extremely interesting and sort of shocking components of learning about Bergoglio's life, etc. So what was one of the most surprising elements you learned and you discovered throughout this process of researching for pilgrimage?
Well, I think, you know, the influence his grandmother had, it sounded almost like an incredibly idyllic childhood. His dad is an immigrant from Italy. His grandparents are immigrants from Italy. Family business in Argentina goes bankrupt. A Salesian priest essentially keeps the family together. A couple of years later, when Bergoglio is in elementary school, his mom got sick, and again, the Salesian priest came in and put the children in boarding school and took care of them. And the grandmother, Rosa, living next door, is an incredible, just sounds almost ideal in kind of a perfect setting. She's a woman who is a peasant from Italy, stood up against Mussolini in a public square on a chair and denounced Mussolini. So she clearly had a lot of energy and gumption, and she essentially raised Bergoglio in the Catholic faith. As his mom and dad had, you know, more children, the grandmother played an even bigger role. But it's not, you know, a big theoretical Catholic faith. It's the stories of the saints. It's the ritual of playing the rosary. And in a town, in a country that's heavily Catholic, she also taught him a lot about understanding other denominations, other religious denominations, and being accepting of those. He told a story about how he saw people walking around that dressed like nuns, and he said, "Aren't those nuns doing that good work?" And his grandmother said, "No, it's a different group of people, and they do very good work. You know, be respectful of them." So you have this sense of the importance of Catholicism, but not being critical of other entities that are struggling and other people that are struggling to understand God. And then, you know, he goes into, when he's in essentially high school, he goes in and studies chemistry, and he's taught by a woman from Paraguay who's an atheist and who challenged him, but who he clearly loved dearly. He was already decided to become a Catholic priest, but he still interacted with Esther and learned from her and respected her. So you have, you know, a couple of very influential women in his life. They exposed him to different parts of, thinking. I mean, he goes in and is trained as a scientist, if you will, by an atheist from Paraguay. Mm-hmm. And he becomes who he is. And he clearly remembers both of them. He clearly carries around a little prayer that his grandma wrote him when he became a priest, carries it around with him to this day and reads it every day. So there are these little stories throughout the book and people I met that just give you an insight into his mercy and his involvement as a human being. And he was very authoritarian, very strict disciplinarian when he was in his mid-30s, and that clearly has changed from that time to who he is today.
We have Patty from Baltimore on the line with a question for Mark Shriver. Patty, you're on America This Week.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Yes. I was just calling in. I was listening to the stories in the book, and I was just kind of interested to find out what was kind of his favorite part of the journey, and or his favorite part of the book, or what was the favorite story, something that really kind of touched him.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks a lot, Patty. Mark?
Well, it's a journey. So, you know, going down to Argentina and seeing where he was born and raised in his, you know, very modest home, seeing the park where he lived and the school where he went to pre-kindergarten, or give you a real sense of the man, and then seeing where he lived in, you know, when he was studying to become a Jesuit, and Collegio Maximo, the school where he taught as well for, you know, almost 30 years of his life, the single bed he lived in, the very austere room he lived in, the bureau, it's amazing that the man spent so much time in such, you know, meager surroundings. I went up to Cordoba, where he spent 2 years in his life, and that was also a single bed in a very small room that backed up to an alley where he was awoken during the weekends by, you know, students who went to Cordoba University. It gives you a real sense of how serious he is about, you know, being meek and not spending a lot of money on things that don't matter. His focus on Jesus and his focus on his mission as a Jesuit priest. And then, of course, you know, I mentioned earlier the interaction I had with Sergio Sanchez and the folks that are very, very poor, not only in Argentina, but around the world. In Bergoglio, Pope Francis' strong commitment to and relationship with those people. In what he says to them about staying together, about working together, and that they have real power. As an American who has been in political races and has been involved in politics at both federal and state level, you know, he's talking about power in a totally different way than I've understood it. So that has challenged me right to my core.
Yeah.
Do I think that poor people have the power to change the situation? Do I really want to listen to them? Do I really want to interact with them and be with them? Is a lot different than the way I used to look at the world.
And that's why I think it was so appropriate and interesting that you titled the book Pilgrimage, right? You weren't some investigative journalist or biographer, but you were a pilgrim, you know, trying to learn more about this man and what he could tell you about your own faith. And that's, I think, what makes it really interesting. Teresa from Columbia, Maryland is on the line. And everybody calling in today is from Maryland. It must be Mark because you're from Maryland. Teresa, you're on America This Week.
Hello. Yes, I was been very interested to learn about the Pope. He's a very fascinating person. And I wanted to know, what's the most surprising fact you learned about the Pope's life in your research?
Teresa, thanks a lot.
Well, I think you know, the story, people know about his fall, but I think the depth of it, to me, it was pretty amazing. You know, to go from being provincial and then running the school there, Collegio Maximo, to essentially being sent to the interior of Argentina and without really a job description, to help bathe the older Jesuits and feed them and to listen to confessions from the community, you know, is a real fall. And then his regrouping and coming back, I think, makes him more relatable as a human being. You know, we all experience bumps and bruises. We all experience setbacks. I think that the fact that the Pope did that and he went, you know, had this great interior crisis, as he calls it, makes him more relatable as a human being. I think that was, to me, a really important part of his life and very insightful for me.
Yeah, and I think I agree. I think that was, again, as I mentioned before, kind of seeing how you, the parts that were insightful for you throughout the book, and just, you know, you talk about the inspiration that he has given you. You emphasize how his sort of focus on humility and mercy inspired you to practice both better. So I think it's interesting to see how you kind of navigate both those worlds, so to speak.
Well, I'm trying to do it. If you talk to my wife or children, they're going to tell you I'm not doing it much better than I was beforehand, but I'm trying. At least I'm aware of it. I mean, one of the things, Father, you know, the Jesuits, a couple of them I talked to down there said, oh, well, you know, he really wasn't exiled. It's not that big a deal. But that's, you know, people go from being provincial to, I guess, Father Kallenbach went from being the head of all the Jesuits to being an assistant librarian in Beirut.
Right.
But I will, you know, when they go off the record, they will tell you that he caused a deep split in Argentina, but that he came out of that with much more humility and much stronger sense of mercy, and that that has permeated his life ever since. So I don't know if you had an opinion about whether maybe it was God's divine hand in this thing, or, you know, whether that is normal, that if, you know, you do get demoted, because the Jesuits always told me that there's no such thing as a demotion, it's just a new calling.
Right.
I don't really know whether I'd buy that, to be honest with you.
Well, we do have a custom where, you know, you serve as a provincial, which is the superior for a particular region, and where you have charge of a certain number of men for a specific period of time, between 3 and 6 years. And then you go back into the ranks of the Jesuits and you become, missioned by the new provincial wherever it is that he wants to send you. So, for example, the superior general that just stepped down, Adolfo Nicolás, when we asked him in the press conference, what are you going to do? He said, whatever the general directs me to do. You know, it's that sense that you sort of hand over power and head back into the ranks. And, you know, because the provincial is charged with so much important decision-making, he's never popular, right? So if people say, oh, he was unpopular as provincial of Argentina, I say, well, no provincial is ever popular because you have to make some really tough decisions. On the other hand, this was a very specific socio-political and ecclesial context and with a very specific set of challenges. And by his own admission, he was unprepared for it. And in the anxiety and fear that created in him came out the worst in him. And so I think this is a classic Jesuitical answer. I know that it's kind of both, but I think that it is kind of both, you know, that they're in terms of the, it's not uncommon, you know, to have an uneventful transition where you go to do something that's, you know, not as big and public as it was what you were doing before. But on the other hand, there's something to his specific story that that I think you rightly allude to.
And I think you get the sense, from him, it, as I said, it makes him more relatable. He has a creed that he wrote that I put in the book. And he, you know, acknowledges the fact that he's a sinner and that he has made mistakes. And this is, you know, prior to the whole situation before he was provincial. And, you know, when you read that creed, he obviously clearly strongly believes in God. But he also understands that he's human and that, he has faults and he understands he's a sinner.
Yeah.
So to me, it makes him more relatable than some faraway saint who, you know, seems to be perfect. This guy's not perfect. He knows it. And that makes him, as you said, you know, in his weakness, he gives him more strength.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And he's also unafraid to bear witness to that, right? So he not only acknowledges his own imperfections and his own weakness and his own sinfulness, but he's not afraid to talk about it and to talk about it in an open way and in a way that's transparent. And that probably comes from, in part, his experience in Argentina when, you know, an authoritarian figure by definition kind of holds everything close to the vest and is jealous of information and all the rest. And so that kind of transparency that he's brought to the processes in the Vatican and in the Synod of Bishops and all of that also probably comes from that experience. So it not only forms him, that quote-unquote setback or failure, not only formed him as a Christian, as a person, but also as a manager.
Makes him much stronger.
Yeah.
And much freer.
Yeah.
And that's why I think he doesn't fit into the category that, you know, so often in America we want to say, well, is he a Democrat or a Republican? Is he progressive or conservative? And he's really none of that. He is free to speak what he thinks and preying on what Jesus is pushing in that direction.
Right.
And he admits he makes mistakes, but he doesn't fit neatly into any category.
That's exactly
right. That's what makes him so fascinating, I think.
And what is what is the formal release date for Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real
Pilgrimage? Comes out, the book comes out on Tuesday after Thanksgiving. And that's when it's in the bookstores, and I'm going up and doing a going to Boston, going to New York, Chicago, traveling around the country, and it's wonderful. It's a chance to talk about a wonderful, challenging man.
Well, that's fantastic, and I'm sure it makes a great Christmas gift. Right.
Yes, it does.
From your lips to everyone's ears.
You know, I also have to say that I'm a Cape Codder, and for the first time in about 20 years, I was up on the Cape in Hyannis, and I went to go visit my grandmother's grave, and in Hyannis, and I learned, because I hadn't been there in about 20 years, that she's now buried about 50 feet from your parents. And
fantastic.
That was a great grace to me, because I was such a great admirer of your parents, and that I was just very touched by that.
Well, thank you. It's a beautiful location right there, and I guess technically it's Centerville, but it's right close to Hyannis. And
yeah.
The beauty of it is that our family comes together a lot in the summertime, and we go to Sunday Mass over at Our Lady of Victory, and then go over and visit my mom and dad at their gravesite every Sunday. So it's fantastic. We're with them all summer long. So that's a huge blessing.
Oh,
thank you for saying that.
No, of course. It really touched me. I was actually baptized at Our Lady of Victory, so I was in the same neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
So, Mark,
small
thanks.
Small world.
Yeah, indeed it is, isn't it? Yep, and it's even smaller on the Cape.
Yes.
Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy Thanksgiving, and happy Thanksgiving to all your listeners as well.
Okay. Take care. The book is Pilgrimage, My Search for the Real Pope Francis by Mark Shriver. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, after the news summary, we're going to be talking about Catholic labor priests with Father Cleet Kiley. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Number 5.
A new report has found the Catholic Church is one of the most culturally diverse institutions in the U.S. and that it needs to adapt and prepare for this growing diversity. The report by Georgetown University found that of Catholics living in the U.S., 42.5 million are white, almost 30 million are Hispanic or Latino, 3 million are Asian, just over 2 million are African American, while 500,000 are American Indian or Alaskan Native. Of those who responded to the survey, the median age was 62 for white Catholics, while Latino Catholics had a median age of 39.
Number 4.
Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York has called for increased efforts to stop legalized physician-assisted suicide. The Cardinal, who chairs the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Pro-Life Activities, said the practice undermines the heart of medicine, and urged Catholics to join medical professionals, disability rights groups and others in fighting for the authentic care of people facing terminal illness. Cardinal Dolan was speaking after the practice was approved by the District of Columbia City Council, while Colorado recently became the sixth state in the nation with a so-called right to die law, joining Washington, Oregon, California, Vermont and Montana.
Number 3.
Pope Francis created 17 new cardinals on Saturday, including 3 from the United States. They include Cardinals Blaise Supich of Chicago, Kevin Farrell, formerly of Dallas and now Prefect of the Vatican Office for Laity, Family and Life, and Joseph Tobin, whom the Pope recently appointed as Archbishop of Newark, New Jersey. During the ceremony, the Pope said the cardinals must dedicate their lives to being ministers of forgiveness and reconciliation, in a world often marked by hostility and division.
Number 2.
Cardinal Raymond Burke has said it may be necessary to make a formal act of correction if Pope Francis doesn't answer a letter from him and 3 other cardinals asking for clarification on aspects of Amoris Laetitia. They say the Pope's exhortation, which opens the way for divorced and remarried Catholics to receive communion in some circumstances, could be read as contradicting church teaching. However, some church leaders have dismissed the criticism, including new Cardinal Joseph Tobin, who said the opposition is not widespread. He called the criticism naive, stressing that church teaching on marriage cannot be reduced to black and white answers. Cardinal Blaise Supich said those raising concerns may have to look inward for clarity. Meanwhile, Cardinal Kevin Farrell said pastoral guidelines for implementing Amoris Laetitia should have been discussed at the recent U.S. Bishops' Fall Assembly, to avoid division and misunderstandings.
Number one.
Pope Francis closed the extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy on Sunday with a celebration of the Feast of Christ the King in St. Peter's Square. At the end of Mass, Pope Francis signed a new apostolic letter in which he called on the Catholic Church worldwide to promote a culture of mercy in a world marked by polarization, violence, exclusion, and the pathology of indifference. The 19-page text called Mercy and Misery also announced that Pope Francis has given priests worldwide the faculty to pardon the sin of abortion, something which was in place for the Jubilee year and is now in place indefinitely. The Pope also extended the faculty to absolve sins to the priests of the Society of St. Pius X until, quote, further provisions are made. He said the apostolic letter was written to ensure the Catholic Church's focus on mercy does not end with the closing of the Holy Door and the Jubilee year.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.